Reviewer Update for July 15th, 2018. I'm Philippe Bonoffa.
I'm Patrick Mifflin.
I'm Brandon Perkins.
And I'm Lee Lamb.
And today's a bit of a special show. We've had guests in the past, and we will continue to in the future, but this is one of those episodes where we're bringing in a guest for a specific topic. Today, it's going to be this amazing world of retro and modern gaming that's just colliding in an amazing and unique fashion. We've got stuff like remakes coming out. We've got independent publishers who are doing retro-style games. And then we have hardware and software for old systems. It's amazing. I know I say amazing too much, but it really is.
Game that came out this week.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, we will be talking about Octopath Traveler as well. And we'll be doing so with Castlemania Ryan, who's joining us today from CastlemaniaGames.com. Yeah, be sure you go and check out that store and say goodbye to your wallet, because...
Yeah.
I'm on the website. You're not kidding.
Yeah. Thank you for that intro, and thanks for having me here. I'm glad to be on the show with you guys.
Well, you say that now. Just give it time.
Yeah.
We've just started, so you know, I'm sure we'll give you plenty of reasons to hate us by the end of the show. So, So with that out of the way, I should probably get into Octopath Traveler, because I know there's like three of you here who are actually really interested in talking about it. Well, two, Pat and Brandon, who have actually been playing it, and Ryan, who's got it but hasn't started yet. So,
yeah.
I'm just going to turn the floor over to you because I don't have this game yet. Everything I'm seeing about it looks like it's something I want. So, Pat, well, it's up to you.
Staying out of spoiler territory because the game's only been out for 2 days now.
I hear I'm just going to say that, paths.
Yes. it's very much like a saga game where you pick the protagonist and then mm-hmm. play through the story while interacting with the other cast members in so doing. I'm going to stay out of spoiler territory and just say, for what it's worth from me, this is the game you look at and then look at Square Enix and ask, what took so long?
Yeah.
Because I think this is the game that a lot of us... I mean, Square Enix used to make games like this on a tri-monthly basis or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And... if this is a sign that they're on the cusp of returning to form, I know Tokyo RPG Factory hasn't quite been living up to what Studio Asano's been doing, but if it wouldn't take a whole lot of effort to fully right the ship and get running on all cylinders in that regard, and when that day comes, it will be a day to celebrate.
Yeah,
you know, I bought it for support. I have not played it. I probably will not get around to it for a while. But the thing, I did play a bit of the demo, and the thing that I can't get over, the thing that made me buy it, even though I'm not going to play it for months, is the art. Like it yeah. feels like the kind of old school game that I want now. Mm-hmm. Just from the art style, like you can do some cool effects that use current tech, but like. I don't know, man. I'm playing a lot on Steam these days, and I just miss sprite work, and it's good to see yep. this kind of stuff coming back to home console.
This could like have been a Super NES game.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Well, no, it couldn't be a Super NES game, because part of the appeal of the graphics is that they managed to take a 16-bit surface and turn it into a three-dimensional object. Part of what makes this game so absolutely visually stunning is this sort of diorama kind of effect that their 2.5 HD, as they're calling it, graphical style gives, because it's essentially like, how to describe it, it's kind of like if you were playing like a Lego RPG.
See, my take from everything. It looked to me like what they would have made a new Final Fantasy Tactics like with this, as far as like the sprite work and everything. That was the vibe I got. Was like
I think it's the same artist,
kind of. Yeah, except
it,
like
with it is actually the same artist, the guy who did that, and I think, God, what was the other? Because I definitely recognize the artist. Yeah, Bravely Default. Yeah, it's also got a bit of Final Fantasy IV in it as well. With the way the class system works.
Yeah.
And here's a real sort of obscure. A lot of, you know, because I've played this, but and some of us may have played this, but most people outside of the who have not, because it was never officially released outside of the out of Japan. Live Alive, yep. Or Live Alive, depending on how you want to pronounce it. That whole thing of having, you know, eight different stories, all with sort of different themes and ideas, with the exception that, unlike in Live Alive, you can actually like recruit people from those other story paths and stuff into your party.
Yeah, they all interact with each other because the stories are all running concurrently.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing, and for the record, I don't think anybody knows this yet for certain, because this is a long-ass game. each, like, individual path of you play as your player character is, like, a good 25, 50 hours alone.
That's substantial.
Yeah, whether or not all of these individual stories will finally, like, at the end intersect into, like, some sort of grand final episode type plot, I don't think anybody knows yet.
No, but sure hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
I mean, they're
all
literally traveling together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would be a huge missed opportunity. I don't know. That's one of those things where, like, the cynical part of me is, like, it seems like they got everything right, and then if they don't have them interact at the end, that would be, like, pure, like, Square, like, damn it. You guys, like, you had one job, you could have made this, but I don't know. Who knows?
It's kind of like a studio. Yeah, it kind of operates kind of like a Canterbury Tales type thing, where it's all these different people you come about, and they've all got their different stories and different goals that they have to meet. And what's really neat about it is that, unlike, like, a lot of, like, major JRPGs, what they do here is that each individual character has very sort of personal stories, and it's, you know, they're not all off to fight the big evil emperor or, you know, to take down the empire. It's like, you know, there's this one girl who was a princess who was reduced to being a dancing girl, and now she's out finding the people who killed her father. Or there's the thief who is trying to track down these different gems for this rich family because they somehow tricked him into getting into their mansion, and now he has to hunt them down because they put this, like thief's band on his wrist, and
they screwed him over pretty good.
Yeah. It's really personal stuff like that.
Yeah. I actually want to bring Ryan in, because I know, like, he hasn't played the game yet, but I'm sure you've been following it. So it's like, what is your take on what you've been seeing for this in the past few months?
Well, it's a lot of what you guys have said. It's kind of like one of those what took so long type of things for me as well. So, for example, Final Fantasy II or IV was my favorite Final Fantasy, is my favorite Final yes. Fantasy game. And for me, a lot of that, because I played the first one and waited for the next one to come out. So I played that game when it came out. And one of the things that took me by surprise was when I started losing party members and then getting new party members and then losing them and having old party members come back into the story.
Yeah.
Coming off of Final Fantasy I, that just didn't seem it was cutting edge, you know, and it yeah. was a way to expand the story, you know, and the ability to tell a good story for a lot of the reasons you guys just cited, these people having unique problems. In that game, Edward, you know, he had lost his wife, which was, I think that was Tella's daughter, mm-hmm. and all these different things that were kind of pulling them together for different reasons. And it's not that good storytelling hasn't continued since then, but we kind of lost, I don't know, it felt like the gameplay was a little more immersive in some ways because it wasn't so action-focused. So when we lost the turn-based style of RPG game playing, that for me wasn't a plus. And it's Agreed. Something I've wanted back, yeah. So, I mean, some games do it well. You know, people will cite Secret of Mana, which is also one of my favorites, and that was not a turn-based style. And I think people kind of took that idea, and we just kind of went exclusively in that direction, and I don't think that was a great move, particularly for Final Fantasy. And I know a lot of people disagree, but, you know, with Final Fantasy 15, you know, for example, that's a game I really wanted to play, and I got it, and I just didn't get very far in that. And, you know, I felt like I would take a break, and then I'd have to go back through the tutorials to learn how to use the fighting system again and all that kind of stuff.
And it says Final Fantasy on the box, but you don't really see it when you play.
Yeah. So for me, this was when I saw this, and you guys were talking about Final Fantasy Tactics. I did get a vibe from that, you know, visually. I saw that it was turn-based, and, you know, I can just count on sort of game for a good story, or I should expect that. I just, this was something that I felt like I'd been waiting for a while. And,
So visually, the fighting style is, the combat, when you see it, it is pure classic Final Fantasy. The regular, like, most of, for the record, none of the sprites in the game, unlike in old Final Fantasy, are static. They actually, like, they actually move. But, like, you'll notice, like, regular enemies will have, like, small, regular, very detailed sprites, but, like, bosses will be, like, huge. It's very striking effect. And one I've missed, to be frank.
See, I think the reason it appeals to me personally, because I'm obviously not going to play it, but the reason it appeals to me personally is to kind of go back to what you guys were saying a minute ago. Like, if we're talking about, like classic Castlevania, or Castlevania, sorry, classic Final Fantasy. I'm still tripped out over your name. That's Castlevania. It's great. Anyway, the thing that is, I think, is interesting to me about all of this is I care a lot about the way that things are designed and, like, the form of things. And one of the big issues that I've had with a lot of games recently over the last 5 or 6 years is that I feel like a lot of times the design of the characters or the actual systems seem to kind of be working against the kind of story that they're trying to tell. Like, I'm not interested in the action focus of Final Fantasy 15, and frankly, one of the things that turned me off, especially about 15, was that female mechanic, because I know mechanics, and none of them dress that way. And not trying to be like, oh, you know, SJW or anything else like that, but, like, I feel like I fired up Xenoblade Chronicles 2. And really cool game, and enjoyed what I've done so far. But then you, like, one of the things I noticed is the, what's the girl's name? Is it Pyra? I can't remember. I haven't played it since.
Yeah.
I haven't played it in, like, 2 months. But, like, she's supposed to be all shy and meek, but she's dressed like a space stripper. And it's like, and it really crystallized what my problem has been with a lot of Japanese RPG games over the last 5 or 10 years has been that I don't feel like the worlds are cohesive, particularly in the design, because it works against what the characters are actually supposed to be. And when I played through the demo in this, I did not feel that way at all. And part of me wonders if that is too because of the graphic style, so they can't do something absurd with some of the characters. Like, you know, you're not going to have a pixelated character with, you know, gigantic breasts. Like, that's just not really going to work very well. Or you're not going to have, you know, you're not going to have somebody that's, like, super, like, meat bound. It really leaves more to you to put your feelings about the characters onto them rather than it being so overt. And then also, I think that works in the design rather than against it, which has been a big problem I've had with a lot of Japanese games recently. So that was the thing that made me pick it up, because I was like, this cohesively looks like this is going to be great, because I haven't seen anything that would indicate the sort of major structural problems that I have where the game works against its own character designs. I don't see that present. And that's exciting to me, because that's the way Square used to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, fan service is great, but as long as it, like, makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to put a bow on it, I'll say, while we'd all love for Square Enix to return to doing exclusively this kind of game, we're pretty much all in agreement that that's never going to happen. At the same time, though, the fact that they are putting an effort into games like this is very encouraging. Maybe
if they can at least do it consistently, I would be pretty happy.
Yeah, if they realize that finally, you know, there is a market for this. It doesn't have to be a huge market, but you know, niches need to be served. And if they can do that, that's great.
Well, the encouraging thing about that was that Yosuke Matsuda was pissed off about the sales of Bravely Default being left on the table for Nintendo to just snap up when they went ahead and published it because Square Enix didn't.
It points to their. I think this is something else where Square is going to get smart about this stuff because, you know, typically for a lot of Nintendo platforms for Square games, Square, frankly, was, I don't want to say lazy, but I'll say lazy in the fact that they or actually lazy, we'll change that. They were risk averse. So, you know, they were having Nintendo publish the Dragon Quest games and just not getting involved in that. And they still seem completely blown away when Bravely Default did as well as it did. So hopefully this is one of those things where there are people, the business folks on the side of things are going, you know, this is something that we can invest in. And then we want to, because even if you do it from a pure profit motivational standpoint of, we were given Nintendo half of our lunch for no reason. Like, it's obvious these games have a place. And I think that's the most interesting thing about what's been going on with the Switch is that the Switch has proven, I think more so than the 3DS ever was capable of doing, that there is a really large market for this kind of thing. Like, I think for a lot of Japanese developers, what they're seeing now, because I've been doing a lot of reading since I haven't been on the show, and I haven't really been able to play games. And one thing that I see consistently bandied about with the Switch is that Japanese developers seem to be surprised at how well indie games are doing. And so then you bring out a game that looks pretty much like an indie game now, and there's cachet there for that now. And I think it's also really telling, because, you know, one of the things that we've always talked about on the show is kind of how the middle of the market fell out, you know, over the last generation and a half. And indies have filled that spot. And so I think it's also telling these huge companies like Square and everybody else, like, you can make a game that looks like this, you can make it a little bit smaller, you can make it feel this way, and people will buy it, because the market has always been there, but for the most part it all shifted to PC, and now they're seeing it kind of come back. I think it came back with the PS4 and a bit with the Xbox One, but I think they're really seeing a hard slide with the Switch, because the Switch is tailor-made. I don't know about you guys, I don't ever really play my Switch on my TV. I always play it undocked. So It's my new indie machine, you know, because I'm not doing that much on the Vita anymore. And it's like, it feels right to play it there. The only thing that's missing is the D-pad. And I think they're catching on to it. I think you when Nintendo's out front and they're all of a sudden they're really successful, then that's giving companies like Square going, wow, there's a space for this kind of stuff. And the funny part is the space is always there. Now they're finally catching up. And I think that's a great thing.
Mm. All right.
Before we move on, I have to ask, because it's sort of a typical question upon our guests, especially when old school RPGs come up. The Legend of Heroes, Trails in the Sky, have you tried it?
No, I haven't actually tried that one, no.
It's what the doctor ordered. Secretly the best thing about the genre. It's everything that we've described here.
Yeah, it's one of the best kept secrets in PC JRPGs. Yeah, definitely worth checking out if you have it. Also, Olivier is awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a PSP game, it looks like.
PSP. Yeah, you can get PC. The first two on Vita, and then, or you can get all three on the PC.
Yeah, you can get all the PC and also the Trails of Cold Steel, which is kind of sort of the sequel series. You can get those on PC as well now. So.
Yeah, like if you like portability, the Vita is a good place to play them. You just won't get the third one, but the PC has some interesting tweaks. Like you can speed the battles up and things like that, so it can cut a considerable amount of time of the game off if you don't mind being, you know, tethered to a computer. But I mean, it can run on a potato. You don't have to have anything powerful.
Yeah. No.
All right. So let's get into this amazing world of gaming. Seeing as I've already said amazing like 40 times today, I might as well just keep with it.
I was amazed.
It's the title of the episode.
It's amazing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let's start off with Ryan and maybe give us a little bit of background on your gaming past and what led you to start the store.
Okay. Yeah. As far as gaming past goes, I mean, I started on the NES, and, you know, I'm a child of the 80s, early 90s, born in 81, so grew up with that, and, you know, my first RPG, for example, was Final Fantasy I. Played a bunch on the Super Nintendo. That seems to be where everything exploded for that. Played through to about GameCube era, and then I took a pause from gaming. So that was early 20s, just kind of got busy with other things, playing music, being in bands, that sort of thing. And then when I got back into gaming was tail end of 360, and just I kept everything that I had had over all those years. So I had everything, and I pulled everything out of the closet and kind of fell right back into it. Started the store about a year ago. One thing I guess I kind of glossed over was in the early 2000s, late 90s, about 99 is when I started getting into retro gaming, when kind of pretty much nobody else was. And it was just because, honestly, I went into a pawn shop looking for just inexpensive PS1 games, and I noticed that they were selling basically any NES game, regardless of what it was, for a dollar or two.
Ooh.
So, yeah, so I would just go in there, and at that point, ooh, I was still a senior in high school, and I would walk by the pawn shop every single day by necessity, just because the bus stop was right past it. So I would usually just wander in there and see if anything new had dropped in, and spend a few bucks and get NES games. And I was the only person really, you know, like people would come over and I'd have, you know, 100 or a couple hundred NES games, and it just, nobody had ever seen anybody collect like that before, you know? And that was it. So I mean, I was really into gaming, always have been, and am now. So started the store about a year and a half ago. Just decided to do an online store. It's, you know, an easy way to get into things. I think a lot of us like the idea of working in a video game store. I hear that from a lot of people anyway. And, you know, anyone can do that and get started online. So that's what I did.
Yeah. Was there a particular problem that you were looking to solve with Castlevania games, or you just one of those things like, meh?
Like, yeah, a little bit of both. It seemed like a good idea, but also too, there's so many great products that are coming out, and they land on so many different unique sites where you have to go to this site to get this one thing, or this other site to get this other thing. And I was trying to source some of these solutions myself, and it just was getting, I don't know, it seemed like an obvious thing to do was to bring everything together into one site, which has been my goal, and we're continuing to do that, bringing on a lot of unique items, some exclusive items, things like that. The other thing that I had always wanted to do, that I suspect you guys want to talk about a little bit, is bring back games or bring games over that never made it here.
Yes.
And so I wanted to get a, you know, get a platform together in order to do something like that. Because there are so many games that were left in Japan that never made its way here or received such a small print run, just because it was at the tail end of a console's life or something, you know, to that end, that most of us know about them but don't have an opportunity to own them. And so I think the more we can bring those games out, and also, you know, support these old consoles to work in our new setups, the more things like this will grow and be here to stay for longer. You know, because once you get through that list of games that you had when you were a kid, then what? Right.
Right. Then you start looking at,
that's when you start with the drugs.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, yeah. Maybe that was just me.
Yeah, it was just you.
It was just me. Sorry.
This just took a cathartic turn.
Yeah. So is it just you that runs the store, or you have employees now?
Well, I have one employee. I'm also married to her, so okay. It's husband and wife.
Yeah. Oh, dude, how's that working out? Do you get to tell your wife what to do? Because, like, it's been my experience, and every person I know that's married, we never get to tell our wife what to do. Think carefully about what you're about to say to her. She might listen to this.
I mean, we have different roles for the company. So she's an accountant by trade, and so she obviously handles all the bookkeeping and accounting side of things.
Right.
I do all of the marketing and most of the customer service inquiries and things like that.
Well, let me ask you if you don't mind. Are you doing okay? Because I have just some background. Like obviously you can tell all of us have been doing this a while, but I've also had friends that have done arcades and had shops and things like that. And I know it is a tough market to deal with. So obviously if it's just you two working, obviously you're kind of keeping it slim. But are you guys good? Is business booming, or is it you're just kind of threading the needle? If you don't mind my asking.
Yeah, no, that's a fair question to ask. Because a lot of people are threading the needle and they aren't doing good. Or it's a dream that doesn't really work out the way that people thought.
Right. It's kind of like a pipe dream, like just like how anybody thinks working at a game store would be awesome, but then you have to deal with the public.
Yeah.
Working at a game store for us is definitely, it's like any other business, really. You've got shipping and receiving, you've got inventory management and customer service that you've got to take care of. So, ultimately it's not just sitting around playing games or just talking about games all day. It's really just work. It is work. But for us, some of the things that make us different or have the opportunity to succeed is, for one, while you could come to our store, it's not really a retail store. It's just we just rent a warehouse space, and it's just simply that. It's a shipping desk and a roll-up door and aisles of stuff that we ship out.
That's cool. Yeah, that's there's a audio. Well, they're not a startup anymore, but there was a in the audio world, there was a company that made a really big splash, kind of doing something similar to that. Their name is Shit Audio, which it's a very interesting story about the name. But they ended up really there were some guys that were like hardcore into sound design and everything else like that, and basically just said, we're going to do this by ourselves. But they have the same thing. You can't really go. They don't have a storefront. I think they may now, but it was the same thing. Like warehouse, this is what we're doing. It makes the customer service easy because they're answering emails and stuff like that. Nobody's just walking into the store. So
yeah,
it seems like a similar thing.
Yeah. It's a lot more cost effective way to do things. Honestly, I don't know that there's too much of a future in brick and mortar retail. I just don't see it as much. So I don't have any intention of ever opening a full retail store. So we're online only. We do conventions. So when we have a retail presence, it's at things like Portland Retro Gaming Expo or some of the other Northwest expos that we have up here. And we do about 3 a year. This year we are doing the Cowlitz Gamers for Kids Expo, which is John Hancock's expo that he runs and has organized, the Seattle Retro Gaming Expo, and those two have already happened. And then the next one is in October for Portland Retro, which of course that's, some people say the biggest in the country. I think there's some other conventions that are getting up there as well, like Too Many Games, for example. And that's one that I definitely want to visit next year just as an attendee. Not going to make a lot of sense for me to try to set up a booth there, but you never know. So that's what we do. And the other thing is we have a lot of products that are unique to our store. If we had to survive on just selling the same stuff everyone else is selling, it probably wouldn't work, in the long run, or it'd just be more of a hobby than anything. But having items that are unique to us or exclusive to us give people a reason to come and then also pick up while they're there those everyday items that everyone else is selling. So
yeah, I notice you seem to have a pretty good relationship with Retrobit as far as their products are concerned. And I think one of those exclusives is the R-Type Returns set.
Yep, R-Type Returns and Holy Diver are coming out in a matter of weeks at this point.
Yeah, you have no idea how much I want to buy that right now.
Yeah.
But I just moved, so at this point I am broke. So that's something that's going to happen. Hopefully there'll be enough stock by the time my funds replenish. So,
That's solving one of the initial things that we'd set out to do. That's solving for that. HoiDiver, of course, is a game I think a lot of us either didn't know about and know about now and want to play, or we had heard about it, or we maybe seen some repro carts of it. But this is the first U.S. release for HoiDiver. And then the other, with R-Type Returns, is a multi-cart with Super R-Type and R-Type 3. So an R-Type 3 being prohibitively expensive. So with this release, we're taking care of, you know, exactly what I had said earlier, which is games that are just too expensive or they just never came out here.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a good opportunity that just kind of worked out timing-wise between us and Retrobit. And that's definitely exciting. A lot of people are looking forward to those.
Yeah, and if you have somebody's ear over there, I noticed that they haven't done any cartridge releases for the Genesis yet, and I'm just thinking, you know, the Shining Force series, 1 yes. and 2, would probably make a very good multi-cart.
Yeah. so Sega definitely has a strong future with Retrobit, and there will be some announcements, even some at Portland when we're there, about some future projects that are coming out and some debuts of some things as well. But that's definitely top of mind. I don't know if you guys had seen, they have a direct partnership with Sega now.
Yeah.
And yes, they're releasing a lot of controllers. Yeah. So they've got Bluetooth controllers for the Genesis and the Dreamcast coming out, and the Saturn as well.
I refuse to play a Dreamcast or use a Dreamcast controller unless it has the cord on the wrong side, just like the regular Dreamcast did. It's not authentic, and it's not worth it.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, this one will be wireless, but you know,
maybe I can install my own.
Yeah.
Just to feel awkward.
Just have it hanging.
Can you put a nub on the bottom?
I'm sure we can manage that.
Yeah.
They're re-releasing the Duke. Why not? Right.
Yeah, yeah, Hyperkin re-released the Duke. That was an interesting one, too.
Yeah.
The best thing I ever saw when they were talking about the Duke is somebody took a picture of it on the internet and put it on top of a PS2 Slim, and it is the size of the PS2 Slim.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, look, it's about to eat it.
I still maintain that the Duke is one of the most comfortable controllers I've ever used. So
it is still very good for the original Halo, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It also helps that if you have guests, they can stay in the Duke.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the memory card port, there's plenty of room in there. So, yeah. So there's this argument, I would say, between the collectors and the people who just want to enjoy their games. Personally, I'm not of the opinion that these two things are mutually exclusive, but there's a lot of people...
I already know where you're going. I completely agree.
So what's your thought on how repros kind of affect the... I already know what you're going to say there, but how the collectible value of some of these games is going to go down as a result of this stuff?
I think they should exist, obviously. And I'm not really particularly worried about original release games value going down. I'll say I've seen, even just from the NES and SNES Classic Edition, some of those games values have come down, but I think that's also just part of games coming down overall. But I noticed Castlevania 4 is going for $30, where I feel like it was double that before.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's a bad thing. I mean,
doesn't it feel like it's almost correcting the bubble that it feels like collectors have gone into? Like,
yeah, it does.
Yeah, it's softening it for sure. So it's probably the better way to go rather than just crashing altogether, but just kind of gradually easing down. There are going to be some people that just want to play the games, and this gives them a way to do it in an official capacity. And then there's some people that just want the original. For various reasons, you know, and I'm in that camp too, for the most part, within reason, and that's fine too. So I think, for a long time, the only way to play some of these games was to either emulate or to buy a very expensive cart in a lot of cases, and this is just introducing another way to do it. I mean, ultimately, if somebody wanted to, they could have emulated anyways. So, right. And I don't see that as doing anything but growing the community, really. Because when you emulate a lot of games, or a lot of times people who emulate games and collect, play the games, find the ones they want to buy, and then seek them out. And that's, I know a lot of people that are like that. But the more people you have getting into this hobby, the more things like what we're talking about now are going to exist. More options are going to come out, and it's just going to really just grow what we're doing, not shrink it. So right. I see that as a good thing.
Well, we talk about that a lot here, too. It's like, you know, I think what's interesting, too, with what we're seeing now is that games really are for everybody. I think we've always known that. But I think you're especially now seeing the industry really shift to try and deal with those issues. And, you know, the movie industry wasn't like, oh, well, there's only, you know, 10,000 copies of Casablanca, therefore no one else can get it and we're not going to print it again. Like, I think there's definitely something to be said for the collector's market and the people that are in it for that, but I don't think you should restrict games strictly because you might be worried that, you know, Phil in Nebraska might lose $20 as opposed to letting the world actually play something that they might have missed. And if you're, especially if you're anyone that's in the camp of video games being a type of consumable art, then I think you would be against the idea, or rather for the idea that these games would be able to reach as wide an audience as possible in whatever manner that they could. Because to your point, you know, there are people that do want to. I'm one of those people. I could pirate things all day, but I do like physically owning the items of the things that I'm playing. And I've invested a lot of money to be able to do that stuff. So something about having an original controller that's really kind of important to me. And then being able to put something, even playing with like, what do you call them? I can't think of the name, and I have one, an EverDrive or something like that. It still feels wrong to me. So, but then what are my options for getting something legally? You know, that's where the, you know, that sort of gray area comes in. So yeah, I think collectors can suck it. In other words.
Yeah, well, I mean, and maybe investors can suck it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're just buying these things just to put them in a box and watch them appreciate in value and try to buy low, sell high, that's not really what this hobby is for most of us. And a lot of us just want to play these games. So I'm also of the mind that it's just, you know, people say game how you game. You know, some people have the idea that you have to use original hardware for everything. Some people have a bias against things like the EverDrive, and some people, that's just a matter of convenience for them, or for budgetary reasons, and all of those things are fine, because I think our preferences change as we get into the hobby as well. You know, your standards might change, you know. So
convenience plays a huge factor too. Like, if you don't have the right kind of setup, being able to play some of these games and actually have them look okay can be a really big hurdle. And I think that's especially what you see with why the stuff like the SNES Classic and the NES Classic have been so popular, because you're getting what you're giving away for people to play these old games, even, you know, that they would have played otherwise if they could actually legitimately just hook up their old equipment. And the fact that it's from Nintendo is, of course, a huge bonus, because it's not like a cheap piece of garbage that's going to die on you. Or it doesn't feel right. Like,
somebody needs
stuff
to...
like that.
Yeah, and I actually, because he kind of brought it up just as an aside, wanting to play like a lot of these old games on like old hardware, that's becoming increasingly more and more difficult, not necessarily just because of rarity, but just because by the persistence of time, especially the SNES. If you've looked at any SNESs lately, it's no secret by now that they were not necessarily built to last.
Brandon, it's SNES.
I'm keeping quiet here because this is something that keeps coming up. So, which kind of
that's true though.
Which kind of leads me to there's a whole class of people now who are just, well, basically finding these consoles in whatever state they happen to be in and refurbishing them and selling them off to people who want them. So it's creating another a market entirely.
Yeah, and definitely a market that people need to be educated on and have some knowledge around too. Because that's a dicey area. in my opinion, and I think something that people need to be careful about. So what I'm talking about specifically is modding consoles and or just even refurbishing them. I mean, there's some people that will do a really good job recapping a system where they're removing the old capacitors and putting in new ones, and or possibly even RGB modding them or HDMI modding them. These are things that you need to be educated about as a consumer, but they're great ways to go if you can find a good modder. And
well, Ryan, what is a good way to do that?
You ask them for pictures, first of all, of their work. If they won't share a picture of their work, then just move on. So you need to see how their work is done. If they're covering their stuff in gobs of hot glue and epoxy and stuff like that, and it just looks like a mess, then you know that, you know, you're going to have problems. So you can get all kinds of visual interference from bad mod work, where you're seeing just artifacting and things like that on screen when you're playing. And yes, you can hook it up to your modern TV and it's technically working, but there's some quality differences. So, I mean, there are recommended modders out there that do good work. And then especially on eBay, if they're not showing pictures of their work on eBay, just don't even... don't even do it.
Well, I think it's really interesting you brought that up, because Pat and I have a background in the fighting game community, and one of the things that has happened by necessity when we started having old systems were the only way to play, you know, these older games that you had tournaments for, the modders became inherently important. Like back when you just wanted to get a regular arcade stick, you had to go through either some guy that was working out of his garage or a company that's defunct now, like Moss Systems. And then even now, you know, you have all these guys that are still doing, you know, tons of work, dual modding, triple modding sticks and things like that. And so I know from experience just in the fighting game community, like to your point, it is very important to see the kind of work that you're looking at, because especially if you're dealing with something that at this point is finite, where, you know, you may not be able to get your hands on a system that might be as in good a condition as the one you have now, you have to be very careful about who you're giving it to make those modifications, or you can end up with something broken that doesn't work right or things like that. And then you have no way to recoup your money, because you're not dealing with like someone like Nintendo or somebody in an official capacity.
Right.
I'll just say there's a couple of monitors off the top of my head that I can recommend. Voltar is one of them. He's excellent. And if you've seen the video he's done of going into an eBay NES, that was he had to actually be drunk to do that one, because it was just horrifying. And the other guy that I know of is Game Tech US. He also does very good work. So
check those guys are both. And I believe Game Tech even has a list on his site approved modders. You know, so that'd be a good resource to go to. Voltar is actually who I send my stuff to.
Yeah.
Those are people that I would recommend. We're getting to that point where we're maintenancing these consoles and trying to get them to continue to work and work on our modern TVs, of which the standards for video are changing on even those. So it's going to be something that we're perpetually working against and trying to keep up with. The other thing that's a challenge that most people aren't even aware of is power supplies. So you need to find a good power supply, and your original power supply might not be the best solution for a lot of the same reasons. So it has failing components and internal to those as well. And a lot of times you can see just noise in your video signal just from the power supply. So those are things that people are looking into, approved, or accepted, third-party power supplies for these original systems are going to probably become more and more of a thing as we move forward and topic of conversation, because these old ones are just going to become a problem. Even the original OEM ones is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and I know Retrobit has actually started releasing some of those as well. If I am not mistaken, they're for the Model 1 and Model 2 Genesis, I believe.
Yeah. Mm. I think as we move forward, we're going to see kind of a higher spec level of third-party power supplies. I don't know that there are a lot out there right now that are up to spec. We do have one on our site that is made the way they used to make them, which is a core and coil style with copper windings inside. You can feel it when you hold it. It's not built with it's not an electronic transformer. Like, it's very lightweight like that.
Right.
But I'd like to see that develop a little bit more, that technology. And I think we're going to start seeing that short order. It's just out of necessity.
What I wish somebody would do do a single power supply that could power a Genesis, Sega CD, and 32X with one brick. That wouldn't be impossible to do, maybe back in the day it would have been a little bit too difficult, but nowadays it probably would be possible to do that.
Right. Yeah, and I know people are looking into those things, so these are things we'll see coming. But yeah, I mean, we're trying to keep these old systems alive, and obviously we have new options and we have old options, but it's an interesting, you know, kind of problem to have, and there's no shortage of solutions out there for it.
Yeah. We've also got another solution entirely, which is clone systems, which take another approach, and it's rather than trying to keep the old systems running, they just kind of reproduce them in varying levels of success.
Yeah.
You've got, you have a few from Hyperkin and Retrobit on your site that I've noticed. The last time I tried a clone console was the Retro Duo, and that was horrible. I have no idea if they have improved since then. But, well, maybe that's something you can speak to.
Yeah, they definitely have. I would say they've come a long way. They're constantly tweaking the emulation to be more, as close to one-to-one as they can get it. Of course, they are operating in a price point that is probably more entry-level, and they're using a different type of emulation. You have software emulation, hardware emulation, and then you have FPGA, right? Those are all variations of clone consoles with all kind of different expectations for performance and features and benefits even, too. So, Retron 3, the Super Retro Trio, for example, is a good, it's a good system to grab for somebody who's getting into the hobby again and wants to play NES, SNES, and Genesis, but doesn't want to buy three different consoles. Instead, you can spend that extra money on games and probably upgrade down the road. And that's what I was talking about earlier, where I said, as you get into the hobby, your own preferences will change and evolve. You know, there's no reason to go in getting the highest end thing option if you're just getting into something. I mean, what if you just want to play a game a little bit and then you're done, right? There's no reason to go buy an analog product to do that. So, and then some people.
And plus, that's a funky rabbit hole to go down, because then all of a sudden you'll be like, oh, I suddenly have no wallet. No savings, and I have no house to put this thing in.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, just getting a clone console and spending that extra money you would have spent on a higher end option on some games to just see if you want to stay in this, or if this is a thing, or if this is what you thought you remembered, is a great option. But then, as you kind of grow into this hobby, you may decide that you want to go into getting the original hardware, and you may decide that you want to look into different video cable options or different scaling options. I mean, you can get an inexpensive one, for $20-$30, an upscaler, and plug that into your TV, and I guess you could make the argument that that's better than getting a clone console, but I don't know. If you're going to go the original route, you might as well have that in mind that you're going to use, a higher, go with something that's going to give you a better result. So if you're going to use the Super Nintendo, get the HD Retrovision cables, maybe run that through an OSSC. But now we're talking hundreds of dollars. So for $80, you can get a clone console and you're already started. So those are kind of some of the things I think people are comparing and why I think there's an option for everything, really. Because you've got people that also, they don't have room to hook up 3, 4, or 5 different consoles, but they want to play games on all of them. That's where something like the Trio or the Retron 5 can be fine. Now, do they have exact one-to-one sound? No. Colors? Probably not. And is there any input lag? Some, you know. So there's some trade-offs to be made. Now, on the other hand, with the Retron 5, you can patch in translation on, you know, you can play an RPG, you know, Super Famicom game and patch in the translation and play that pretty inexpensively. And that might be a good option. So I don't know. There are a lot of opinions. Some people hate clones, some people like them, but I think they have their place. It just depends what you're doing and where you're at in the hobby.
Yeah, I think the option being there is cool, because I think you let people determine their level of involvement, because, you know, one of the things that I think that's actually kind of hurting this like Nintendo and those folks in general is the availability of something like the SNES Mini or the NES Mini. Like, the fact that people were paying their mortgages off of the NES Mini like a year ago is absurd. And the chase needed, you know, for somebody that just like, you know, I just love to play, you know, R-Type again, or, you know, something, and I don't want to deal with an emulator, and I want to deal with all that crap. I still have the old cartridges here, and I think that's definitely serving a niche that or a niche that even, you know, Nintendo is going after to a certain extent. But I kind of wish it'd be that kind of thing where they would produce something that could play cartridges. But in the meantime, you know, just like we've seen with the indie game scene, if these big folks aren't going to do it, then somebody smaller is going to come in and do it and fill that void.
Absolutely. And we were talking a little bit about Kickstarter projects earlier before we went on live, but one of them was NES Maker. Did you guys see that Kickstarter project?
I have not. No.
Okay, so that's one that we supported, and what it is it's an interface software that is designed for, you know, somebody who is you know, it's entry level, and the user interface is designed for, you know, to be very welcoming to somebody that's not you know, a game designer, but wants to make a game or has an idea for how to make a game. And so it has all these different modules and things like that that will help you construct whatever type of game it is that you're wanting to make, whether it's a platformer or an RPG or these various types of things. And that project was very successfully funded. And I would think over the next year, because I think they're releasing the software in August, September, I could be wrong, to the backers anyways, and then it'll be for purchase to anyone else. You know, we're going to see a lot of people making games, and we'll see all kinds of, you know, levels of quality to that, but there will be some great games that come out of that will rise to the top. So I think, you know, we're just getting started on a lot of this stuff as a community, and we're finding ways to grow it ourselves, exactly to your point. If these other companies aren't going to do it, we're going to do it, and we're seeing that. Now, and not to be unfair to the bigger companies out there, we are seeing companies observe the fact that we want these games. I mean, we talked about Octopath Traveler, but we've got Bloodstained, Curse of the Moon, we've got Sonic Mania, we've got a lot of cool games that are coming out that play exactly to our niche here. Shovel Knight was probably the first really big, reputable one that showed that this wave was coming.
And it's been great seeing everyone come to the table like that.
Yeah, and Axiom Verge was another one that was one.
We are big fans of Axiom Verge.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we'll see a lot more of that to come now that NES Maker is coming out.
Yeah, that's crazy. I never even heard of that. I'll have to take a look at that, because I have a 13-year-old son who is very into designing his own games, and he's been messing with like RPG Maker and trying to figure out stuff in Project Spark down to like actually like getting into coding. So that's cool that there's something there, because I think too there's something to be said when it comes to the creative process about not having an unlimited amount of freedom. Like when we look at some of the games that we loved growing up, a lot of the things in those games were born out of the fact that the platforms themselves were limited. And I think that it's good, especially, and again, seeing in the indie game scene, And with this kind of stuff, it's really important, I think. Well, not important, but I think you're seeing really interesting works come out of, you know, sort of having some of those limitations in place, whereas now they seem to be more about not having the tools, but more about, like, what kind of budget you can have and things like that, and what your game is going to look like, so you can have an artistic choice in those parameters that can make something interesting and really kind of harken back to folks like us, like, oh, this is the kind of thing that we're looking for, as opposed to feeling like the only way that I can make a game is if it needs to look like Assassin's Creed. And if it's not, like, cutting edge, yeah, if I can't throw, you know, $500 billion at it, then it's not going to be successful. And I think, going back to what I had said at the beginning of the show, with, like, particularly with the Switch, I think this is sort of really reignited for console makers how important indie games were, because I think they were very important. You know, we saw it happen with things like Braid and stuff like that on the Xbox 360, and I felt like it sort of kind of started to die off, and the Switch really thrust it back into the forefront. So I'm the idea of the NES maker sounds super cool. I'm actually really, really curious to see what that's gonna yield.
Yeah.
So it kind of brings us to, well, we kind of touched on it a little bit earlier, and new releases for old platforms. And, well, NES Maker is going to open up a little lot in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we have, well, Retrobit, who's been re-releasing, but I want to talk about new releases, something like Fork Parker's Crunch Out, new game for the SNES, Devolver Digital is publishing, which is weird. This is kind of weird because it's also kind of like a charity project, and it's meant to benefit Russ Pitz's take that for mental health issues. And I kind of wonder, like, it's an interesting thing to do, but if you want that to be a charity donation, I'm not entirely sure that's the most optimal way of doing it, but it's still really cool. The fact that we are getting new SNES games and NES games and Genesis games, and thanks to all the repro tools that have come out on the market, and it's easier than ever to do this. It's like, you used to have to cannibalize old cartridges to do it, but
yeah.
See, the only thing about that would freak me out is if I was somebody doing that is, like, obviously you want to make some sort of money. Like, or maybe money is not the most important thing there, but I would just strictly be thinking about it too. Like, who specifically am I focusing this on? And really, like, is there, so since we got you on the show, do you have is there a quantifiable way to really look at how large that audience is, particularly when it comes to, like, who actually has access to these old consoles? Because that'd be, you know, if you're dealing with, like, a console maker, like, oh, well, we're going to put this on PS4, then you have an idea of how many consoles are out there. But it seems like doing a repro or a repro cart and going, we're going to put this out, like, that would be, from a business standpoint, that would scare the shit out of me, because I'd be like, I obviously know I can sell this to someone, but who are they and how many of them are there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a good question. And so Holy Diver and R-Type are our first step into this, and we did 1,000 of each. R-Type is just about sold out, but Holy Diver sold out pretty quick. So, I mean, it can depend on the title, I suppose, too. But
Super Donkey Wars probably not going to get a lot of sales.
Yeah. So, and even these games aren't, you know, Holy Diver isn't something that we all knew about, you know. R-Type is, but not everyone's into, you know, shmups and playing, you know, games like that. So it can be difficult to tell. IM 8-Bit released the Street Fighter 2 special anniversary edition about a year and a half ago. Oh, they did that for Capcom?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they did, I think their run was something like 1,500 pieces, and they didn't have a problem selling that out. They're doing Mega Man now, but they upped the quantities quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And I think they...
Those blue copies look so cool.
Yeah, they look cool, definitely. But it seems like maybe that quantity size was a bit too much. So,
And forgive me, I wasn't trying to imply that it's a bad idea or anything else. I was more trying to get to the idea of where are you even getting the idea for these numbers? Like, what is, again, how do you quantify, like, what is going to do well by you guys, and then but also not hurt you, because like we talked about at the beginning of the show, like, you know, for a lot of this stuff, it really is kind of threading that needle. And you know, it seems like I listened to something from when I was in the hospital with my mom. I listened to Retronauts, and they had the God, what is the I'm sorry guys, forgive me, I can't think of the name. The guys that are doing Limited Run Games, where they talked a lot about like how they try to figure out their numbers and this and that, and for it seemed like for like the first year and a half that they were in business, they were just completely chasing it because they just had no idea how to really spec any of it. And they were just kind of getting blown out of the water because it was like, okay, some of this stuff is going to do really well, some of it's not. And it was really just kind of a crapshoot in general. So that's kind of more where I was getting at. So I apologize if I came off as being like, what are you doing? Because that certainly wasn't my intention.
No, I didn't take it that way at all. And in fact, I was just double checking. So the Mega Man 2 is 8,500 cartridges versus 1,500. So I think that was a bit of an overshoot. It's just based on the fact that they're still up. But I wish them luck. I mean, I like those guys and that team that's putting that together. And but how do we put our numbers together? Well, we just went with 1,000 of each because that was what we were confident we could sell. And or willing to risk. And so that right. kind of numbers worked out for us so far. And when we do our next run of games, it'll probably be the same. We're also operating at a little bit different price point. We're doing $60 for our sets, and we'll try to hold to that as much as we possibly can, because we're trying to keep things you know, within reason, affordable for people. But also, I think the other thing is, it depends on the title. Like you had mentioned with Limited Run, some games are going to do well, some aren't. The other thing that's going for them is just their track record. And so that's something, as we establish that, and we've released multiple games, and more people become aware of who we are and what we're doing, that'll affect our minimum orders as well. I mean, this was our first game, and you know, we're just kind of introducing ourselves to that market right now. So 1,000 was definitely something we felt we could do. And it looks like we're done with Holy Diver and we're about to close sales on R-Type. And by the way, when I say we're done with Holy Diver, we're done with our exclusive run. We are selling the non-exclusives as well. But
okay.
Yeah, so those are still up for sale. But we placed a minimum order for 1,000 of each. Yeah.
So I better get on that.
I need to get on that now.
Yeah, they're cool. I mean, they've got a lot of extras thrown in. We did some lithographs and art prints and things like that. And we had, looking for his name, but we've got a guy that did artwork on R-Type that does a lot of animated shorts on YouTube, and we were able to get that approved signed off on so that we could release, because all this stuff is official release. IRM signs off on everything.
Nice.
And royalties go back to them, and it goes back to the original creator or the companies, you know, that created these products. So it's very much an official release, and with the exception of how things were done back when we were kids, was Nintendo produced all the cartridges, and it was officially released by Nintendo. So it's in that they don't do that anymore. It's as official as it could possibly be. I mean, that's how we wound up with Tengen games, you know, and they were making so back
this
in the day,
change for the better.
Then Capcom and IRM and everybody, they had to send all their stuff to be made by Nintendo, which is just wild to think about, but that's how it was done.
Yeah, it caused so many issues in the past. So how do you negotiate something like this? Do you just go and say, you know, you've got this cool ass game that we think that we should print, and they're just like, okay. Or I mean, is it truly that simple, or is it you know, because I know I've done business with some Japanese companies in the past, and I know a lot of it is, at least in my experience, it's almost been like courting them. Did you experience some of that, or is it really just like a, you know, them recognizing the market that there is something here, and you're somebody that's coming to them and saying, we'll do this?
Both. So what happened on this specific one was, you know, about a year ago, maybe a little more, I had created a whole business plan and proposal with financials and just a very detailed plan. And I had brought that to a couple of companies, and one of them was Retrobit. And then we met in person and went over some different things at CES and putting stuff. They had access to these games via their Super Retrocade launch. And so we kind of married up everything. It turned out they were talking about, or they were already looking at doing this, putting games together. And I had walked in with a business plan proposing exactly what they were working on. So it was just a timing thing where it just worked. And I already had a good relationship with Retrobit as a, you know, a seller of their products and, you know, knowing them and working with them already. So, yeah, so essentially they were looking at putting cartridges together. I didn't know that. And I walked in with a business plan talking about how I wanted to go to market with this. And
so they're like, hey, look at this guy.
Yeah, so it just worked out. It was just one of those things where I approached them, and it was perfect timing for what they were doing.
Yeah.
So oh, that's awesome. That's definitely fortuitous.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there other technical challenges as far as doing repros on a scale of 1,000, or has that pretty much been sorted out?
So they're printing, I think it's 3,500 of each. Okay. And 1,000 of them are exclusive to us in that the cartridge color is different. Okay. So on Holy Diver, they're going to come out, they're going to be black. But the first 1,000 sold were through our site, and they're white. And then the R-Type is going to be kind of like a dark blue color. And so that's how we came up with those colors is we put them up for pre-sale, and we had a vote. You know, we had a survey put out, and we collected well over 1,000 responses, and those were the two colors. For a while, they were very different colors, too. As a matter of fact, they changed right at the end to, at least Holy Diver did. I think blue was always leading for R-Type, but Holy Diver was going to be like a chrome color initially, like a black chrome, and it just looked like it was going to be that, and then at the end white came through.
Yeah, there's something really cool that about having those cartridge colors, like, you know, you had Nintendo do it with Killer Instinct, and then like you had the red one for Maximum Carnage, and then of course going back to the original Zelda with getting that color cartridge. There's just something so cool about having that, and I think that really matters now, especially to people that are going to be putting up money to buy this, is to give them something unique that they can also look at, because that's definitely part of the experience. That what's interesting is that's part of that sensory experience that's been lost now with like digital games, is you're not getting an instruction book, you're not getting something like where you're looking at the sticker on the game, you know, things like that. So just having something else that differentiates that, I think, is super cool.
Definitely, yeah, and we definitely wanted to recreate that and throw in as much of that as we could to these releases. So we've got instruction books, we've got the lithograph, you know, the art prints and pins and things like that. So it felt like a complete experience, even more so than back, you know, back then, because we didn't have a whole lot of special edition, you know, collector sets that would come out that would have this much stuff jammed in it. But returning to that and adding these cartridge colors was definitely something we knew we wanted to do.
Yeah. So what do you think about maybe disc-based re-releases? We had premium products a while back, you know, when Working Designs was still at the top of their game.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you think
still have to work design stuff.
Yeah, I think we will. And there's just a different set of challenges. And so with the cartridge releases, our biggest challenge was making sure that our cartridges were 5-volt compliant, which I didn't want to get in the weeds of, but it's important to note that they are. The long and short of that is that it means it's in spec to the console and to the original way that the games were made. With disc-based media, the challenge, of course, is not really discs. We can make discs, no problem. The challenge is having consoles that are reliable enough to read them. And that's where I think we're going to need to see clone consoles actually step in and solve some problems for us, because it's going to come down to either that or having original spec replacement parts made, which seems less viable. I mean, it's not as consumer friendly. You'd have to buy a part and have a modder, you know, or a repair company, you know, put things back together for you or sell refurbished.
Yeah.
But having a clone console that's designed to play these games out of the box, I think is going to be something that's friendly to a lot of people.
You know? I feel like that's probably where it will go because, you know, we have right now, it's easy to, if you have an original system, to then get a cartridge, right? Like, because there's not that moving, part factor where it's like, you know, I'm sure we all remember having a PlayStation where you had to put it upside down for it to play properly, or if you had a PS2 that had the disc read error and things like that. So definitely a whole different set of challenges there. And I wonder what that will do too to this kind of market, because it feels like it's a much easier thing to just jump in and say, well, we're going to create some cartridges because there's not a lot you have to worry about from there beyond like, okay, is the system clean? Okay, and the card is clean. So it's most likely when they flip that power button, it's going to play. Whereas, you know, the state of those moving parts, the lasers, everything else like that, just like you said, it's going to create a situation that I think a lot of people wouldn't be that comfortable with. Like, okay, I got to find somebody to put this new laser in and things like that. And I know they had talked to, I've read something, you know, when they were going on with Saturn emulation where they're looking at basically doing like a hard drive that tricks the hardware into thinking that, you know, it actually has a disc in the system, but that defeats kind of what we're talking about now, which is producing products for that kind of thing, where collectors or even just people that want to play these games would pick them up to play that stuff on original hardware because you have that moving part factor. So I'm curious to see what this will do, you know, for that retro market, because it feels like that's going to be like the wall, right? Like just having the parts and the ability available to actually make this stuff playable again seems like it would be a big problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there are people already. The Dreamcast community specifically gets new releases all the time. So there are people making games for these systems now, but it hasn't kind of hit that point where it's what most of us are thinking about or talking about yet. So we're still kind of on the cartridge media, but there are companies. There's a company called Polymega that is, and I think they used to be called RetroBlox, but they rebranded as Polymega. Hmm. And they're making a clone console that'll read. I want to say they have a module based system where you can plug in and out different drives into their base system. And they're looking to give you a way to play all of these old disk-based systems. So they're the first ones I know of. Yeah, right now that's doing that, and they're not out yet, but they're releasing this product somewhat soon. And you'll be able to play everything from cartridge media to disk-based media on this system, and there will be others too. More people will come along to create, you know, solutions for these problems, because this is what people want. So we'll be interested to see how that plays out too. I think this round was interesting. This last kind of wave of kind of getting into these things was a little different because we had clone consoles first, and then once we had everyone with a way to play the games, you know, in the market, we started going, well, what about new games, you know? And this way is the other way around, I think, where people are already creating new games for these old systems, but now the systems are failing. The Sega CD, for example, is just, you're not going to find those around to play, in working condition anyway, not very often. And we'll start to see that with other systems too, the PS2 as well, you know?
Right.
And people bring up, well, you can play it on your PS3, well, that's, of course, just specific models, things like that. But a lot of us want to and still have our libraries of these games. Mm-hmm. We want to play them. We want to plug our original controller into something to play it. It'll be interesting to see how these disc-based consoles and games are handled by the community, really. Are we going to have the same prejudice against clone consoles and for some people, acceptance, saying that it just makes things so much easier for them, or we're just not going to have any choice. It'll be interesting. So
yeah, it feels like it's got to go that way, right? I'm sorry, Phil. I didn't mean to interrupt. I apologize.
I don't think that servicing these old consoles is going to be as viable. in the long run. So I think it'll have to go that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's some folks out there who are still doing the servicing on these.
Yeah.
But finding these lasers is becoming a problem. The gears and stuff, that's not really a huge issue because, you know, those can be fabricated. Those aren't hard. The issue, I think, is for disc-based released is that I don't think anybody really wants to release a disc-based game that wouldn't run on original hardware. So that's kind of, you know, it brings with it its own problems in that you'd have to implement the copy protection that the original hardware had.
Right.
On the Dreamcast, well, there wasn't any, so that's right. Not really an issue.
Problem solved. Right.
Which is why, you know, besides the fact that that community is just very uniquely supportive of the platform, but it's so easy to put a game out on. That's why you see so many Dreamcast games, too, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and there's also I believe there's a Dreamcast Flash cartridge in the works. Actually, I think it's out now. That's weird and also awesome.
Yeah, it's a GDEMU is what that's called.
Yeah, GDEMU. Yeah, I was pretty sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think overall this is something too that as you see these industries crop up, that I think is going to be really important for these bigger companies to really figure out where they want their place in the market to be. And by that I mean folks like Nintendo and Sony and Sega and everything, because you know people are gonna make this stuff anyway. So then I think it really comes down to, you know, what there's obviously, I mean, we've seen it, right? Like if you just look at the SNES Mini and the NES Mini, there is a thirst for this kind of thing. And you look at what Microsoft is doing, where they're working on getting so many games to be backwards compatible. Like for lack of a better term, the PC model is one that makes sense with the video games market being as mature as it is right now. And it's still crazy to me that like a company like Nintendo hasn't really plumbed those depths in the way that I think that they probably should. And I feel like Sony would be the next big one, and they just don't seem remotely interested in it at all. But they also seem like they might be the group that's going to be crying foul later on down the line when, you know, folks like you are getting things published or you know, working with clone console makers and things like that, because this is what people want. Yeah. So do you see, you know, them or any company like that really paying attention to your section of the stuff that you guys do and people like Limited Run Games? Or is it just, you know, kind of out of sight, out of mind?
Well, I mean, Limited Run is working directly with Nintendo and Sony, but that's to release games on current consoles. And I guess that's where if we can port something to a new console, I think they're more... that's the route that they're going to want to take. Now, of course, we're ignoring the whole thing in this conversation about these minis coming out. So Nintendo obviously has embraced minis. Would we see a PS1 mini or a proper Sega mini, you know, Genesis or, you know, something that would include some of the other like 32X or Sega CD or anything like that in a mini platform? I could see that. For sure, from these companies. But I think as far as getting these old games to be able to have a second life, ports is probably more likely. Ports and then also just virtual store type of concept is kind of where they are willing to exist. As far as Nintendo ever licensing out the ability to put out a Nintendo release on a cartridge again.
Oh, yeah,
I don't think that'll ever happen. Yeah, it's unfortunate, and it would work. I think people would. I mean, if they put out a Zelda collection or a Metroid collection on a cart, you know, people would buy it, and it would do very well.
That's exactly why they won't do it.
Yeah,
because Nintendo makes no sense.
Yeah.
Well, honestly, at this point in time, that's not something you would be able to approach them about. But I think as your credibility grows in this space, you actually stand a pretty good chance of getting this done yourself.
Yeah.
To be honest.
Something like that would be, if not them, you know, another publisher. We could definitely put out some of these higher profile games. You know, I mean, there are a lot of games I would love to put out, and we're working on a lot of them. So, I mean, we're not just talking to iRum. We are working with other publishers, and we will be announcing some things soon that are pretty exciting, that are in this direction that we're talking about. So the thing about, and I don't mean to tease too hard, things do change a lot.
Yeah.
Even over the last few months, we've had some things come up and change. So it wouldn't be right to say anything right now. It's kind of like one of those things when the deal's done and we've actually handed over the money, then we'll announce it.
So, like, I don't believe in shit till shit happens.
That's kind of where I'm at. And, yeah. And I want to be very careful about that so that people have the right, you know, information and expectations. But I can tell you is these are games that are going to be exciting, that people are just like these, if not more, people are going to be excited about. So,
yeah, you got to be careful. You know, you tell gamers one wrong thing, you know, they'll get your house swatted.
Yep. Yeah. So, and it's because we care too, you know, and we're excited about stuff. And, you definitely have to be careful about that when you're talking to a community that's passionate as ours. So,
you don't want a Mega Man Legends 3 snafu.
No. No.
A bunch of angry fans walking around. Bitch, I'll kill you. Like, yeah. Whoa, calm down.
Anybody got anything they want to share before we wrap up?
Well, buy Octopath Traveler. It is amazing.
Yes, buy Octopath Traveler and play it to your heart's content.
For me, I got to say...
Actually, I was going to say, I do have one thing I wanted to mention. I don't know, I've probably said this before, and I will say it again. Yoko Taro is one of my favorite developers in the gaming world right now. And it was announced last week that they are actually going to be bringing over, Viz Media is going to be translating and bringing over two of the books that goes along with Nier Automata. First one is the novelization called Long Story Short, which is co-written by Yoko Taro and I think it's June Itsuda, who co-writes a lot of this. But also, they're going to be bringing over Short Story Long, which is the collection of short stories and novellas that are sort of go along with the story of Nier Automata. Some of it you can get in-game, some of it out-of-game, and it's all written entirely by Yoko Taro himself.
Hmm.
So that will be completely insane.
Yes, it will be insane. And it will legitimately be good, too, because... Because Yoko Taro does, like, a lot of writing. He writes a lot of the other materials in the game, like the various stories for all the weapons and stuff. Trust me, he's good.
All right.
So you'll be wanting to, And that's about it.
Yeah, for me, I had mentioned earlier about, I'd kind of played up through GameCube, and then I kind of took a break, you know, in the early 2000s and kind of came back into gaming. The game that I came back into gaming on it was Tomb Raider, the 2013 Tomb Raider. And that game, I played through that game at least half a dozen times. So I love that and the follow-up that they did. And so for me, the most anticipated game that I'm waiting for this year is the follow-up to that. And that's the Shadow of the Tomb Raider. I think that game does, we were talking about mechanics and storytelling and playing to the role, you know, this is a female lead. And I just really enjoy the story of it and how the stealth operations of it and all that kind of stuff. So for me, I'd say that's a game that I'm really looking forward to and something that kind of brought me back in. Which, and by the way, I didn't get out of gaming really for lack of interest in gaming. You just get busy doing other things in life, you know? But I got pulled back in by that. And I think that's why that game, probably why I like it a little bit more than most, but it's a good game all in all.
Yeah.
No, that makes sense. Yeah, for me, I gotta say this is one of those things that's a little bit bittersweet. But for me, I'm about to fire up Chrono Trigger again, because when I was the reason I haven't been on for anybody that's been curious is because my mom had been dealing with cancer, and she just passed on June 2nd, and so I've been dealing with that, and but one of the things that I've been doing is just I had to go through her apartment and go through her things and just kind of deal with her not being here, and it's been very difficult. But what I've been doing a lot now is really focusing on a lot of the good stuff that my mom brought in my life. She really encouraged me, you know, with gaming and with writing, which led me to hooking up with you guys and everything else like that. But the thing that I keep coming back to is Chrono Trigger. And we were really poor when I was growing up, and we went through a point where we had money and then we didn't. And then, and I remember when Chrono Trigger came out, like Final Fantasy VI is my favorite game of all time. I followed up closely with Chrono Trigger, and I played Final Fantasy, you know, III back then. And then when I heard Chrono Trigger was coming out, I was like, wait a minute, this is the Final Fantasy guys and the Dragon Quest guys. Like, I've got to get this. And the cartridge, like here in Atlanta, was like, I think it was like $80 or $85. And so my mom was like, you know, what do you want for Christmas? And I knew we didn't have any money. And I said, you know, this is the only thing I want, Mom. Like, and I just begged her, like, this is what I want. Like, if we can make this happen, like, I won't ever ask you for anything again. And miraculously, she came through that year and managed to get me a copy of it. And so I still have it despite moving and everything else and selling all kinds of like my games and everything else, and I've never ever gotten rid of it. And I have my old SNES out, and I have it hooked up to a Framemeister. And so I'm gonna I think in the next probably next 2 or 3 weeks, my plan is to go back through it. And I think it's going to be really difficult because it's so much of my mom is and who she was and what she did was tied into me with that game. Like, it's very, I think it'll be a very bittersweet thing. But that's what's been on my mind with anything having to do with like retro gaming or old gaming or anything else like that. So that's kind of where my head is.
That's awesome. I mean, that's an awesome way to kind of tie back to something like that. And really appreciate something. I have similar stories to that I won't get into at the moment, but having something like that makes a game like that special is just it's something that game will have that no other game will.
Right, exactly.
It'll help it mean a lot more to you than
yeah,
than
exactly.
It otherwise would have. So,
well, yeah, like I have that, and then like with these fine folks on this podcast, you know, me and Pat and Phil and Teresa, who's not here, but we all go way back to a website called Game Addicts. And you guys remember playing PSO together? I was talking to a friend of mine the other day about doing PSO. Yeah. Like, that's like that. That's one of those things where like I think about it now, and it's like it was a good game at the time. I don't think I'd ever go back and play it now, but like I always associate like the Dreamcast in general with you guys, mm-hmm. and that's why I need that nubby controller, because it brings it back.
Yeah. That being said, there are communities keeping PSO alive on the PC. It's leaps and bounds ahead of the original Dreamcast version, and anytime you want to take a step back to that, I would absolutely be willing to join you.
Dude, I am totally down for that. We'll have to chat about that. And I don't know if it'll hold up, but I'll do it. I'll totally do it.
Yeah. Very cool.
Okay, so I guess we'll end it on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ryan, for joining us. It's been a lot of fun and a little scary, noting the fact that I almost lost this interview. So
yeah.
That was great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no worries.
It's not a good podcast that your butthole puckers up.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you guys having me on. It was a great time.
Yeah, and if you've ever got stuff you want to announce, we're here. Mm-hmm. Just send me an email or whatever. We'll get you back on if the time is right.
Sounds good.
Mm-hmm. All right. So with that, I'd like to remind everybody that if you're not subscribed to the show, you can do so on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast aggregator. And you can also check out our written content at smashpad.com. Recently, we've got the Lumines Remastered review up from Danreb. Spoiler, it's a good game. Because it's mm-hmm. Lumines. So there.
That's all you need to know.
Yeah. So with that, I have been Filippo D'Anolfo for Patrick Mifflin, Brandon Perkins, and Lee Lamb. We'll see you next week.